Welcome to Talk World Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. This week on Talk World Radio, we are talking about peace activism and Gaza. We are very grateful to have with us Kimry Gomri, who was recently on a march to Gaza. She is from Canada. She is, in fact, the founder and organizer of Montreal for a World Beyond War, World Beyond War's chapter in Montreal, Canada, which she founded in 2021. Kimry Gomri, welcome to Talk World Radio.
Well, thank you. Thank you, David. I'm glad to be here.
So I know you've been doing peace activism and specifically end the genocide in Gaza activism in Canada for a long time. How did you get involved with going on the march to Gaza?
To be honest, I forget how I heard about it, but the moment that I heard that there was a march being in the works, it wasn't very long before I said yes, because it seemed like just the thing that I'd been hoping for, something like we felt that we tried so many things and nothing was working. And then this came up and I thought, wow, you know, that's something that might work. I didn't have a lot of, you know, it's not a very realistic thing, I guess, to think that just going and being present would bring peace in the Middle East. But I thought at least this is something we could do that we haven't tried yet. You know, yeah. And it's something like very much in your face and you're present and it's direct action. And it's, you know, we feel so isolated. I mean, we're here in North America. The Middle East is so far away and inaccessible. So we feel kind of, you know, helpless, like you're watching somebody being hurt and you can't reach out and pull the aggressor off them or something. Couldn't do that anyway, but you know what I mean.
I remember when I heard that this was going to happen, a march to Gaza, and I think there's a website, marchtogaza.com, that a lot of people were excited. Oh, I want to go. Oh, how can I go? I got the impression a lot more people would have liked to go if they'd heard about it earlier or been able to arrange their plans. I mean, it was a pretty popular thing to go halfway around the world for this, right?
Well, it started off very, very slow. And actually, it started off with, I think, here in the Canada director is Manuel Tapial, and he got the first people together, and there were six of us. And we were like, you know, how can we do this thing? And there was a very short timeline, and people didn't seem initially very enthusiastic at all. And everything was kind of like, well, if you wanted to endorse the march, then you had to send your email to an address. They didn't have a form you could fill out yet. No one had made that. And we, you know, all the documents and all the supporting the website and everything just evolved along the way because there was a very little time before the planned date. So at the beginning, it felt pretty much like, you know, being thrown to the lions kind of thing. It was certainly like, oh, gee, you know, how are we going to get people signed up? But all of a sudden, about 2 weeks before we were planned to go, and Manuel at that point had said, I'm overwhelmed, I can't, you know, handle, I'm going to cut off the, we'd had about 100 people signed up in Canada, said, I'm going to, because I'm just one volunteer, I can't handle any more registrations, so I'm going to close registrations. And then all of a sudden, all these people started wanting to register, and it just snowballed. So
And you're just talking about Canada, and this was called a global march to Gaza. So this was happening in a lot of countries, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. There were actually two marches in parallel that were being planned that just kind of organically sprung up. And so we initially called ourselves March to Gaza, but then we heard there was another march to Gaza. Ours was centering around the date of June 15th. We would be in, like, at the Rafah crossing on June 15th. And the other one was planning to be there on the 19th. So there was no time to really coordinate, or there was no real, you know, it was too complex to try to coordinate. So they just went ahead, but we changed our name slightly to Global March to Gaza instead of March to Gaza, just so we could say, distinguish between the two dates. Ultimately, you know, what happened,
the flotilla was sailing a ship at the same time, and I thought, maybe I'm mistaken, but I thought you guys or the flotilla, one or the other, had coordinated the timing so that those would be close together.
Yes, there was a slogan and a little image that it was done was by land, by sea, by air. And of course, we were putting a lot of hope into the flotilla and the flotilla. I have seen so many flotillas going to Gaza over the years. I'm showing my age, I guess, a little bit, but I remember, I think in 2009, there was a flotilla and we were so hopeful and we really thought that that would do it. But
Yeah. Well, I imagine you've heard from others, but I can tell you that I've heard from lots of people who were very inspired by you guys going to try to get into Gaza and by the flotilla going, because just as people like you think, oh, here's something we can try, everybody else thinks, oh, here's something somebody's trying. And it's very encouraging, I think, to a lot of people to see.
I'm glad you say that. I have very now I have very I think I'm a believer in, like, you have to do whatever you can do, and you don't do things based on their, like, possibility of success. You do things because it's something you can do that you haven't tried yet, and you have to try everything you can possibly try in the face of, people being killed. And in this case, a very extreme example of a live stream genocide and horrific war crimes. You can't just, oh, we'll try a divestment campaign, and in 10 years maybe we'll divest and everybody would be dead. I'm like, we have to do something urgently. We have to do something very direct.
When you, Kimri, Gomri, when you say the Rafah crossing, for those who haven't been paying attention for decades, because people have tried to go there before, you mean the gate, or rather the wall that's not a gate, between the southern border of Gaza and the border of Egypt, right?
Exactly. And the plan was never to cross right into Gaza. The plan, it's called March to Gaza, but the plan was just to go to the border where the aid trucks were trying to get in. And there's a kind of a checkpoint over into Gaza itself. And the aid trucks were blocked there. So we felt that by going there and camping and demonstrating, well, we would be marching through the Sinai Desert, through Egypt from Cairo, starting at the Al Al-Mamaya. I always have trouble pronouncing that. Encampment, which is, I looked on the map and it's just, it's the Sinai Desert, so it looks like just a big desert. It there's doesn't look like there's a lot of human, activity there. But in fact, when we actually got on the march and we started driving, it was more like a huge auto route in the desert, and there were, weapons trucks and trucks full of soldiers and different things passing along the route. I don't want to scoop myself. I'll say that the actual Rafah crossing is, it's just a point of kind of crossing into Gaza from Egypt into Israel Palestine.
You say you don't want to scoop yourself because you want to tell us the story of what happened. I would say please do. Yeah, what happened?
Well, there was a whole intense planning period, as I've kind of alluded to, where we had meetings. We had meetings outside with the Montreal group. We all wanted to meet each other face to face, and we had a lot of online meetings. And of course, in tandem, the Canada organizer, Emmanuel, was having meetings with the international groups. So they were trying to coordinate all that. And the thing that made this really interesting and unusual was that all the countries were coordinating their participation independently. So they all had kind of their own style going on, and we had packing lists. We had to sign a waiver saying that if it was very dangerous and that we accepted that, et cetera, et cetera. So when all this was finally come together and we'd had our final meeting, we arranged our plane tickets individually. But a lot of us were there at the airport in Montreal, and you could, I'd met the people before, so I could see them, but we were told to be discreet, so we didn't, really speak with each other or mingle together in the airport. We kind of, exchanged glances, and I could see about 20 people I know that were part of the Canadian delegation. And when we got there, it was, so we left on the 11th, arrived on the 12th, and then we had just an overnight in our various hotels, and we'd been given like four hotels that were close to one another where we would book. So we booked there as, people on vacation, very discreetly, just and in our visa we said we were just tourism. So we got through, I got through all of the, customs and everything very, very easily. But as you'll, other people didn't, I'll tell you right now, like in the Netherlands delegation, they made it to the airport. And from the airport, they were all turned back en masse. So that's really, but at the time we didn't know this, but because I got through and all the Canadians, I think, got through fairly easily. But I'm I'd be curious to know why some groups got through and some groups were turned back. Maybe they were traveling more together, or maybe there were just more undercover policemen at those. I'm sure there were other undercover policemen at the Canadian airport as well, at the Montreal airport where I was. But anyway, we got through. I got to my hotel, booked in. People were arriving. We were exchanging all kinds of it's very Mata Hari, you know. Exchanging all kinds of messages on Signal through Signal groups. And we planned to go out the next day. So it was arranged that we would go out. So the next day was the 13th would be the day where we would meet and head to the Al Maya encampment area, which is listed on the map like kind of a youth hostel type of thing, but it's very vague. It's in the middle of nowhere, essentially. So we were told to get taxis, and we were riding three or four to a taxi. So I was in a taxi with three other people, and you know, there was a lot of speculation about the Egyptians and were the Egyptians friendly to us or were they not? In my mind, although officially we weren't saying anything, people were very friendly, and people, I think, often knew why we were there and what we were doing. It was kind of coming out in different ways. I will tell you one example that I knew very well what like. They knew what was happening was our taxi driver. It was an ordinary Uber cab. And when we got to a checkpoint, which I didn't even know, I've never passed through a checkpoint. It looked like a toll booth to me. Well, we got to this checkpoint and he immediately grabbed a wad of bills and passed it to the laughing guards at the thing. And they just took his money and, you know, to send him on his way. I thought, what was that? And I said, the person next to me said, that's a bribe. Okay, why would he do that for us? But I was very touched. But I guess some people didn't get so lucky. Some people were turned back at the first checkpoint for whatever reason. Maybe they looked more suspicious. But why anybody
Maybe
would be
their
going
driver
there?
didn't pull out enough bills.
Exactly, I think. Yeah.
But the
So we.
Egyptian people, Kimri, the Egyptian people are always good and friendly, but the Egyptian government is one of the
Exactly.
worst institutions in the world. It
Very,
buddies
very
with the
scary.
Pentagon and with Israel and essentially a military government, right?
Exactly. One young man said to me, you know, we didn't actually refer directly to what we were doing, but we were chatting at breakfast. He was one of the clerks at the hotel, and he said, you know, here, you can go on protests where you're from. You're Canadian. You can do a protest and you can protest. But if I ever go to a protest, I'll be arrested. So I said, yeah, that's true, isn't it? And he was very young and he already knew that. And we don't, like in Montreal, we joke, we call it Ville des Manifs. It's the city of protests. I mean, it's a student city. So there's protests happening just about a few times a week in Montreal. It's very ordinary. But imagine living in a country where you're so repressed and you can't speak out or speak up.
Well, remember 2011, there were protests everywhere called Occupy, and there were protests all over Cairo, and they threw out their awful government, and there were ordering pizza for the people in Madison, Wisconsin, and vice versa. And you know, but then the military took over and undid it, and they tortured
Yeah.
people and they killed people, and
Yeah.
that's who the U.S. government supports.
Yeah, it's an
Not
old story.
the
Yeah.
people who were for peace and justice in 2011, the people who took it over from them for the military.
Yeah, that's very sad. And that was kind of like I'd never been to the Middle East. There were a lot of things that were kind of a cultural shock for me, was there's a lot of poverty there. Of course, you know, people, it's not an easy existence. And it seems to be kind of in a state of Cairo is, you can see the grandiose, the colonial architecture and what were once, you know, just like awe-inspiring buildings, but they are just kind of frozen in time, like a kind of a memory of what they were suggesting and hinting at what they once were, but nothing has been maintained. I mean, everything is just falling apart. I mean, here in Montreal, they're constantly doing construction, and they say we have two seasons, winter and construction, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, there wasn't any construction or anything happening. Everything's pretty much just, yeah.
Well, that's not what you'll see in UAE and Qatar and some other parts of that region,
Probably,
but that's what you see in Cairo.
yeah.
So you got past the checkpoints, then
Well, then there was another checkpoint and the same thing occurred. You know, he passed the money and we continued on our way. But then all of a sudden we were coming up and there were like soldiers standing in the middle of the highway and cars pulled over and everybody seemed to be just pulled over. So suddenly the driver stopped I said, "What's going on? What's going on?" And they said, "Just we're gonna have to get out of the car. There's the military are pulling people over." So we got out of the car, and at this point, I was very agitated, saying, "We're not there yet. We have to continue." And they said, "No, you can't go on from here." So almost before we knew it, they came by and they said, "Give us your passports." And I thought, okay, we give them the passport, and then they check the passport, and then we'll continue on our way. But actually, they were just rounding up the passports. And I wish, in the confusion, I wish when they said passport, I wish I said I gave it to you already, because I don't think they were really, able to keep track. But anyway, too late. We gave them our passports, and then we were just stuck there. The soldiers and the Egyptian authorities ostensibly took our passports, and then we just kind of mingled around. And meanwhile, there were all these Egyptian military who looked like, 18 years old. They looked very young, very hot, in these big hot uniforms. They were dressed from head to toe in long sleeves and everything. So we just began to mingle in the big area there. There was a mosque there, and there was like a big open area. So we began to gather there just to try to find out what would happen. And after several minutes, we were chanting, there were some speeches, and then somebody said, we didn't really know what would happen, but I was still very focused on, we have to get like the rest of the way and complete our mission. We came here to do a mission. We can't stop, we have to. And I thought, well, just forget about the passports, let's just keep going. But no, they wanted to get the passports back. So I thought they were playing us, because at various places all around the encampment, what was going to be our encampment, it looked like there were soldiers on trucks and things, and they'd be standing there holding a wad of passports, and they hadn't been sorted or anything. So they'd be like, Australia, this name, and then they'd put it to the bottom of the pile, and then they'd say, US, this name, and they put it to the bottom of the pile. And then they so you mean you'd go and you'd stand there for 10 minutes and hear various names, and then, okay, maybe I'm missing out, maybe mine's over there. So you'd walk over there and over there, and after doing this for like 30 minutes, you'd sort of go and consult with each other and say, what do you think? Do you think we're ever going to get it? Well, maybe we should go back. Maybe they come back to ours. So this went on for hours.
They need a government efficiency office, that's
I
for sure.
thought they were doing it on purpose, though, just to play with us. Yeah.
Probably so.
Yeah.
You sent some videos and some photos. There were lots of people. How many people were there? And Nelson Mandela's grandson was there. Who else was there?
Yeah, there were a lot of people we learned over time. There were people that had been turned back at the airport. There was another huge group that was turned back at the first checkpoint, and they were put, apparently, and some of them were manhandled, and they were put on a bus, and they were dumped outside Cairo, and they really didn't have any way to get. They didn't have their passports, and they didn't have any way to get where they needed to go anywhere. So we didn't know about that, though. We were just the ones that had made it this far. So in that group that had been kind of already filtered out a few times, we were about 1,200 people, I think. I know Manuel, when he was speaking, he said we're more than 1,000. But
Yeah.
in the actual march, there were many thousands of people who had signed up for different reasons. By the time this Friday the 13th thing actually came to that point, there was like a little more than 1,000 people, I guess.
And you were in the group that made it the farthest?
Well, we made it to there, and then there were soldiers who were kettling us. They were holding hands and sort of. So I was kind of around with a bunch of the other Canadian delegates. I was around the corner of the building, and we would have liked to go stand in the center to be able to get a better view of what was happening. But I was afraid to move, because I thought if we move, then the soldiers will move in, and then everybody will be more squeezed. So we have to hold the line. So we kind of stayed where we were around the corner of the building. And we were right next to the soldiers, so we were, kind of beside them. So
Yeah.
that was our vantage point. And there were speeches being made. We were feeling very, I was still feeling very hopeful that we'd still somehow manage to get our passports back. And gradually it began to dawn on me that we, even if we got our passports back, that we weren't going to be able to complete our mission and go through to the Rafah crossing. So mentally, I was trying to deal with that, because I had never considered that possibility. I had told myself, okay, we are going to go to Rafah or die trying, and we hadn't got to Rafah, so
But at
I was
some
ready
point,
to die trying.
But at some point, the group you were with made a decision to stop trying, right?
Well, I think that that's where there was kind of like the Manuel, to give you some perspective, Manuel, who was the Canadian director or the Canadian coordinator, he had participated in a flotilla, for example. And I think the flotilla he participated in 2009, people were killed, like five people were killed.
Yeah.
So he had safety as a priority, probably wisely. So, our safety was a priority and all this. And for me, I really felt like this is an action in extremis, and we have to, we have to commit. Like, we have to be ready to deal with whatever we have to deal with. We can't turn back. So I wasn't really liking the idea of turning back. I thought, okay, at least we have to camp here. We have to stay here.
Yeah.
Anyway, I didn't know what the powers that be, the organizers, were planning. But eventually, how did it go down? Eventually we did get our passports back. So that was like, I got my passport and checked with everybody else, and they had gotten their passports back. And then we thought, well, maybe we'll just settle down and stay here tonight and see what happens tomorrow. Now, we didn't have tents. We had planned to have tents, but we did have our sleeping bags and our mats. So the Canadian delegation, we just spread our mats on like the marble near the mosque, and the other people were over in the field, and we thought we'll sleep here. And we were very, very tired, very hot. We hadn't eaten all day, and the stress and the excitement, but we were just really exhausted, and it's very dirty, very
Yeah.
dusty. So anyway, just ready to sleep. We had just started to kind of roll out our mats when somebody, like a couple of strange people, came by that said, "Oh, I'm from the French delegation." Well, actually, I'm Swiss, but I'm with the French delegation. I was wondering, can I sleep with you guys? And we were like, "Why would you want to sleep with us? Don't you want to be with your own group?" And the person said, "Well, okay, if you're going to be like that." And they left. And then someone else came with a similar story and said, "Do you mind if I sleep with you Canadians? Because, and we said, "No." Somebody else said, "No. We prefer to just stay with our own group. We all knew each other." So they left. And then a few minutes later, someone said, "You have to get out of here. The authorities are saying you can't sleep by yourselves. You guys have to go over and join the main group." So, okay. So we all rolled up everything. By this time, like, I had my backpack, but I had unpacked everything. So I was carrying the mat and carrying a couple pillows under my arm. We went back to the main area, and then things began to heat up, and we heard some shouting and some screaming and so on. And we heard, "Let him go, let him go." And apparently there'd been a shoving match with Manuel and some of the authorities, and they were pulling him and holding him, and the crowd was saying, "Let him go." So eventually they did let him go. But the next thing we knew, somebody from our group, who was in one of the organizers, came over, running over, and said, "People are being hit. They hit people with batons. You have a choice. You can either get on the bus now, or you could stay and risk being arrested." So I said, "Oh, good, we have a choice. I'm going to stay and risk being arrested."
Yeah.
And a couple other women that were with me, there was like three or four of us, were saying, "Yeah, I'd rather stay. I don't want to turn back." So we made our way closer to the bus, but then we kind of held hands and sat down and began chanting. But everybody else just went on the bus, kind of like sheep. So I'm judging here. I shouldn't. No. And it was very scary. It was, I didn't tell you there was an earlier time where we thought we were going to be tear gassed, and they gave people the option to leave. They just wandered through the crowd saying, "If you want to leave, no hard feelings, you can leave now." And about 50 people left. That was like a few hours before.
I don't think anybody in Gaza who knows you did this or around the world who appreciates that you did this thinks of any of the people involved as sheep. The
No,
sheep are the
that's
people
cruel.
who
Yeah,
didn't go,
exactly.
people who
Probably
stayed
wiser.
home,
Yeah,
people
cooler
like
heads
me who never
prevailed.
got on a plane to
Yeah,
Egypt, right?
yeah.
So I don't want to rush the story, but we got a few minutes left. What happened next?
Well, it's kind of a blur for me at that point, but basically they moved in, and they picked up, I think, based on the fact that they were a little lighter, but there were two of us were white, and two of us were Arabic. And they picked the two smaller women up, who both were Arab. They say they were picked up because they were Arabic, maybe, but they picked them up, and they actually just lifted them physically onto the bus, kicking and screaming. And one of them had terrible bruises after I saw the bruises on her. She had been really treated very harshly. And I stayed on the ground, so I figured that'd be, and I'm not small, you can see me, and I had a 10 kilogram backpack on, so maybe they were hesitant to pick me up. But eventually, Emmanuel came out and said, "You have to be with the team. You have to get on the bus to be a team player." So they grabbed me. They dragged me a little ways. I guess Egyptian authorities. So I was all dusty and dirty, but they had trouble lifting me. Actually, the backpack took most of the dragging. And then they let me go. Manuel came out and said, "Get in the bus, get in the bus." So I got on the bus and we turned around and we went back. The story doesn't end there. We went back and we went back. Most of the people went to one hotel, but my friends who were with me, we looked at the hotel and we thought, "This, we don't like the look of this hotel. We don't, there's people sitting there that just didn't look like they would look like they were sitting there waiting, and they looked to me like spies." So we said, my friend said to me, let's go to another hotel. I don't trust these people." So we did. And the next day, actually, there were arrests at that hotel. And they were having a meeting, and they were having like a planning meeting. And then just before the main meeting the next day, and some plainclothes cops came in and dragged Manuel's partner out and dragged him out and deported her immediately by a. And we don't know, we didn't know, there was a period of time we didn't know what had happened to him.
And we got just a minute or two left. What did happen to him?
Oh, he was a terror. He was detained and he was interrogated, and then ultimately he was deported too, and he's back in Canada and he's safe. But after we learned that he had been deported and nobody, and they were arresting people on the streets and in their hotels, we were told to, probably wise to leave as soon as possible. So I luckily managed to get tickets and left the next day, Monday. So the whole thing was over in like 3 days.
Well, I'm very glad you did it. I'm also glad you made it back to
Thanks.
Canada in one piece. Are you talking with Canadians? Are what response are you getting from people to the fact that you did this? Because I'm eager to have you on this program. Are people in Montreal interested?
To be honest, I have been laying very low since I got back, and I have been negligent in contacting my mailing list and everything else. And I have to do that very soon, but I've been kind of like in a daze since getting back. I've talked to Rachel of World Beyond War. She was very helpful. She's done this many times, this sort of thing that I did. So.
Well, I'm glad you did it. I'm glad you're not discouraged because you've done something that helps encourage other people.
Well, I hope so. I hope that we have to keep trying. I mean, hope is a moral imperative, right? We have to keep trying, and we have to keep hoping and doing whatever we can to end this.
We do indeed, and there's more to be done, but you're doing a great job. Kimry Gomery is the founder and the organizer of World Beyond War's chapter in Montreal, Montreal for a World Beyond War. Kimry, thank you for everything you keep doing and for coming on Talk World Radio.
Thank you, David.
This is Talk World Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. Read or listen to today's Peace Almanac entry at peacealmanac.org. All past shows can be heard at talkworldradio.org. Talk World Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way.